won't go away. Welcome to your first day. We won't go away. Welcome to your first day. We won't go away.
Get your gun. Welcome to Over There, the podcast about military history and activism in the age of Trump. As usual, my name is Terry Brennan.
And my name is Matt Martin.
And we're going to talk to you about military history, and activism in the age of Trump. So
all of those things.
It's been kind of a busy week. But before we get into like the all the things, how as a person, how are you, Matt?
I'm doing pretty well. Although I think for me and a lot of people in the world, it feels like it's been a pretty rough week. I started out on a high note on Saturday at the Women's March, but it feels like it's been like we're in for some bumpy times.
Yeah, I was actually gearing up for that too. I've actually been feeling relatively, I mean, like I would call it shades of down. Like I find myself down and then I kind of fight my way back up and then I get down. But there was this thing that happened this week that I feel like kind of bad about, but I also don't feel bad about, which is that. So this week, I think it was at the Women's March, actually, it was on Inauguration Day, I think. Richard Spencer, the very internet famous white supremacist, alt-right speaker, got punched in the face by someone from, I believe it was the Black Bloc, which I don't remember exactly. I looked up what they were, but they're sort of like an anti-fascist organization that's a little bit radical.
Right.
But some dude ran up and just punched him in the face during an interview, and I heard about it, and I saw the like a couple of articles about it, and I was like,
is it okay to punch a Nazi?
Yeah, and that's the thing, is it brought up the ethics of, is it okay to punch a Nazi? And I had, actually, there's a number of people on my feed who are like, you know, I abhor violence and I hate Richard Spencer, but he didn't deserve to be punched. And there was a lot of like stuff back and forth. And I was kind of leaning towards the no one, you know, violence is not the answer thing. But two things changed my mind on that. And I don't want to say that violence is the answer, but I want to say that like there are notable exceptions, which I think is, since we're having a discussion about military and military history in the age of Trump, I think that this is this applies, which is that someone like Richard Spencer, I went back after seeing the article about him getting punched in the face. I went back and watched his speech that he gave. I don't remember what it was. It was within the last month. It made a lot of internet news where he talked a lot about, he went to, it was like an alt-right convention in Washington, D.C., and he talked about how this is our time being the alt-right. He said Heil Trump and a bunch of other stuff. And his speech was actually really offensive when you listen to it. It was like very well put together. It was like some of the most disgusting points of view and the some of the most awful things I've ever heard put into like a really well done, like a well manicured format. And it was actually made me even like, it was almost worse that he wasn't like raging and screaming, but he was giving like this very racist, disgusting PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he talks about is what he calls peaceful genocide, which I didn't look that up, but it's
seems
a
like
disgusting
a contradiction.
Word. Yeah, exactly, right? So it was a combination of reading up on his past, reminding myself of this, and watching videos people made to different songs of him getting punched in the face that kind of changed my mind. And I felt really bad because it was more the videos. I mean, like, I saw the videos first, and I couldn't stop laughing. And if you have a chance, you just want to Google Richard Spencer punched in the face videos. And a million of them will come up. The Born in the USA is my favorite, either that or the Whitney Houston one. But it brings up the ethics of, like, is it okay to punch a Nazi? Specifically the fact that, like, he wasn't, like, at the moment, like, actively physically hurting anybody. I think that I want to hear what you have to say, and then I'm going to tell you where I fell on the issue.
Well, you know, as satisfying as it was to see this terrible person get a little bit of comeuppance, I have to say that I'm just generally not in favor of going around punching people because you really don't like, you know, what they have to say. You know, it's one thing when the Nazi tanks are rolling across the border into Poland. Yeah, you're going to have to take some action. But if the guy's just standing there saying terrible things, you can't go up and punch him. I'm sorry.
Cool, cool. So I fall somewhere around there, but not exactly there. I kind of come up on the comeuppance part of it, which is that I actually agree that. So if they caught the guy, I don't think they did. But if they were to catch the guy, I would believe in my heart of hearts that they should prosecute him for it, which I think would be assault and battery. And I think that he should get the standard sentence, meaning like I don't think that they should let him off and they shouldn't like try to make an example of him. They should just treat it as if he punched somebody at a bar because they were having an argument about ideas. That being said, I don't really feel bad for Richard Spencer getting punched in the face. And in some ways, I'm glad it made the internet rounds, because I do think that one of the things that we as liberals get a bad rap for, is that what I want to say? I think that one of the things that happens to us is that because we try so hard to preach the idea of like tolerance or say things like violence isn't the answer, that I think that very bullying figures come along and they abuse what I think is like good nature. I think that they push things further than they would with a more volatile group of people because they know they can in order to push a position. So I was glad to at least see that this made the internet rounds, because I do think that there was a little bit, not even a little bit, there was just too much touchdown dancing in the racist crowds after Trump's election. I think I saw a couple of memes that said make racism shameful again or something like that. And I think that this, you know, again, if they catch the guy, I think that he should be prosecuted like anyone else would be prosecuted, no more, no less. But also that I'm kind of glad that some people might see that and say, maybe I shouldn't say crazy racist stuff in public. I would actually go on to say that maybe they shouldn't say crazy racist stuff, but I'll take in public for now, because it's gotten to be a little bit difficult, I think, recently.
Yeah. So, you know, there is a saying in the history of democracy, and that is that the only good antidote to bad speech is good speech, right? There's going to be a lot of bad speech out there, and, you know, you may be tempted to want to censor that speech or maybe just punch the guy. But that's not going to win the day. That's certainly not going to convince anybody who may have been leaning in the other direction that you're on the right side. The only way to counter that is to present your own good speech and let reason carry the day.
Fair enough. I can hear that. I can see that. I think that sometimes I can say I'm one of the people that get sometimes easily flustered when it appears that reason doesn't carry the day, but I get what you're saying, and I actually understand the bigger part of me actually agrees with you.
Yeah.
I am sometimes in conflict with the pettier parts of me because I have a little bit of I don't have a temper, but I think I get frustrated when I feel like reason has been exhausted and people aren't listening. But again, like I do think that and I think that we're both in agreement that if someone is actively hurting someone else, physically, I don't think that there's any, and I think that unfortunately that's what that speech leads to, but you're right. I think that you have to win the day in the, I guess, arena of ideas rather than the pterodrome.
That's right. And, you know, I think, for example, the women's march that I participated in Washington, D.C. on Saturday resonated around the world, not because necessarily of the message, because when you have that many people together and they all have their own agendas, the message can get a little muddled. But by the positiveness of it, the utter lack of violence or even a lot of negativity, and just the fact that this huge group of people expressing their obvious displeasure, their obvious grievance with their government, that's going to just carry a lot more weight than, look at this guy, he's terrible, so I'm going to take matters into my own hands, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and actually, that's a good segue, because I know you wanted to talk a little bit about your trip. I was out of town at a theater conference on the day of the Women's March. I was actually driving from Madison, Wisconsin, back to Philadelphia that day. So I drove through Chicago hoping I could see the Chicago March, but you couldn't see it from the interstate. But you were in Washington, D.C., and at the big one, right?
I was. You know, my wife and I, we had a very similar experience on election night that millions of other Americans did, and that is we just couldn't we were utterly stunned. I mean, we knew that there was always a chance, you know, the Electoral College being what it is and the red block of states that there are out there. We knew, of course, you know, intellectually there's a chance that this terrible person, Trump, could win the election. It was not like Hillary was a 99% lock to win. She was 70 to 80%, right? So that means that, you know, Donald Trump winning was improbable, but certainly not impossible. But you can know that and still be utterly stunned when it happens. And so I'm sure, like a lot of people, we were on the floor crying at about midnight on Tuesday of election night, and we just couldn't, you know, we couldn't sleep, we couldn't understand what was going on. And then very soon thereafter, we noticed on Facebook that they were organizing this women's march, like on the day after they started talking about it. And so we immediately booked our tickets to go to D.C. We didn't know that there was going to be this huge upspringing of other marches around the country. Just about in every city around the country, there were other marches. If we'd known that, we might have stayed here and marched in the Dallas march. But we booked our tickets early and an Airbnb and a rental car, et cetera, so that we could be there. We weren't sure what to expect. We'd seen that on Inauguration Day that there were a lot of protests in D.C. and some of them had gotten violent and people were arrested. And so we were thinking, oh, this could be ugly. And we were thinking about, well, what do we need to do? Do we need to bring, you know, handkerchiefs and something to protect us from if the police use tear gas or something like that? We opted not really to take any measures other than just to show up and pay attention. But I'm happy to say it was utterly peaceful. There was no negativity at all. There was a significant police presence, but they were in good spirits, and the marchers were thanking the cops as we went past them. And just the sheer number of people was astounding. I mean, I've been in D.C. before when there were a lot of people. I went to the Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart rally to restore sanity and or fear in October of 2010. That was a huge, huge crowd. So I thought, you know, I know what to expect, but this was nothing like that. The march route was planned to be about a mile and a half long. Everywhere you went, though, from blocks ahead of where the thing was supposed to start, there were so many people that you could barely move through the streets. And we managed to eventually make our way to the starting point a couple hours after the march was supposed to start, because that's how long it took to get around. And we got about two-thirds of the way through the route with a lot of other marchers when it was announced that the march had been suspended because there were so many people on the streets that they couldn't move all the way through the route in an orderly manner. And the march permit was expiring at 3 p.m. At 4:30, there were still what had to be hundreds of thousands of people and no way to actually make it to the end, along the march route. So we kind of cut across the mall there and went to the field that's in front of the White House, where, again, you could barely move. It was just an utterly incredible. I've never experienced anything like it. I'm overwhelmed by the whole thing.
That was I had my partner Colleen went down, and she said a lot of similar things. She was amazed at how many people were there. She was amazed at the fact that she couldn't move, and she was nervous. She made sure that I had information. Oh, she said, because she knew I was driving across the country that day. And she said, I'm putting your information on my armband or whatever it was people were doing, writing it on their arm. I forget. Well, anyway, my point is she had that. She's like, your information is written on there. So she knows that I often keep my phone on vibrate. She's like, can you make sure it's on in case someone has to call you?
Yeah.
And she said, though, she said she was really impressed with how everything ran. There were a couple of things that some other friends of mine were talking about, which I think is worth mentioning. I think you kind of touched on it a little bit when you said, when you have that many people in like the same place, that a big part of it is that there's lots of parallel agendas. There's lots of agendas that overlap but aren't exactly the same. There's a lot of, I think the word a lot of people were using online was they were trying to make sure that the rally was intersectional, that there was a lot of Black Lives Matter, along with basically they wanted to make sure there's a lot of people who are really concerned about making sure that it wasn't just like a big white feminist march. And it sounds like that it wasn't. It sounds like there was a lot of intersectionality. But one of the things that people talked about is that, and I think this is kind of important to remember, is that one of the reasons people cited that the rally was peaceful and there were like either very low arrests or I think someone actually said no arrests at one point. But is that it's sort of, which you and I have talked about on the last two episodes, it was a little bit more about how the police dealt with the actual marchers and less to do with the marchers themselves. Not to say that if someone just decided that they were going to start throwing rocks, that the police wouldn't step in and intervene, but that a lot of times when there's a big group of white people who are making some noise, or a majority of white people making some noise, that the police are usually a little more tolerant of the crowd itself and they're a little less reactionary than when it is, say, like a solely minority crowd.
Yeah.
So I just want to put that out there. I'm sure that a lot of people I talked to said that everybody was very respectful and sure. that it was a really positive experience.
Yeah.
But also that one of the things we also have to remember is that, like, when white people are dealing with the police and things like that, that there is there's just a different interaction that kind of happens, like, automatically, and that
sure
and that I think that, you know, it's something we want to move towards in the future. But I did hear a lot of really positive things about the march itself on a lot of the same notes that you were talking about.
Yes, and I think it's really important for middle class white people to participate in this process and to find their African American and friends of color. Seek them out. If you're out there organizing, if you're out there holding meetings, if you're on meetup.com trying to put together postcard parties, seek out those people and bring them into your efforts. And then, you know, if there's other organizations, you know, do what you can to be part of those things. Because, yeah, if Black Lives Matter wants to go and march downtown, and there are no white people there, they may very well have a very harsh welcome from law enforcement. Whereas if there's a lot of white faces in the crowd, sad to say, they're going to get a different reaction, right? And that may have been one of the mechanisms at work at the Women's March.
And yeah, I think that actually Trump came into Philadelphia just yesterday, which was Thursday, January 26th. He came in, he and the Republicans came down to, I guess, have their annual retreat and talk about, you know, what they're going to do about Obamacare. Rumor has it, still nothing.
Yeah.
There was a big, I don't know how big it was, but I saw some videos. There was a lot of big marches during the daytime. Huge. I don't know what the arrest numbers were. I think they were pretty low. They might have been also like close to zero. But
yeah.
But again, I know a number of people actually talked about how the Philadelphia police, a lot of it had to do with the fact that they've been protest trained and they were very respectful. But again, it's one of those things where we're moving in the right direction, but we've got a lot of work. We've got a lot of ways to go. But again, it was one of those things where we had all these people in the same place and they marched through the street and it was much more crowded than I think a lot of people expected when they went up to the march. But it turned out to be a very positive experience. And it turned out to be one of those things where people were able to get their point across. And it didn't have to end in like lots of arrests or tear gas or things like that. But I will say that I know that like the Philadelphia mayor, Jim Kenney, takes the training of the police here very seriously. I was at a town hall with him the other night and he talked a lot about how they're really working on trying to make sure that interaction with neighborhoods of color and things like that are handled above and beyond, because it's a big problem in the country right now. Philadelphia, whew, I've been here a while. Philadelphia is far from perfect in that, but they're really trying to tackle that head on and really sort of fix police and civilian sort of interaction, specifically in poor neighborhoods, specifically with people of color, and specifically in these big gatherings that we're probably going to see more of, because a lot of people are very frustrated with, I think, what's happening in Washington right now.
Yeah.
And confused. I think we're all a little bit confused, like you were saying, like stunned. I'm still a little bit stunned.
I remember when George W. Bush managed to win an Electoral College vote in 2000 because of an act of the Supreme Court, became president of the United States. We were worried, not everybody, of course, a lot of people weren't worried, but me and a lot of people I know were worried that, oh my goodness, he's going to make it hard to get a student loan, right? He's going to squander the economic gains that Bill Clinton ushered in, right?
Which I believe he did.
which he did, right? We were super worried about a recession and about, you know, make things being a little bit more difficult for people under George W. Bush presidency than they were previously, right? We had no idea how bad it was going to, like, we couldn't have imagined. The depths of our cynicism was not nearly enough to comprehend, you know, an invasion of Iraq and an ultimate complete crash of the economy because of 8 years of George W. Bush, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure a lot of us, I know I was one of these people that, you know, during the campaign, when Trump would say something terrible, you know, we would say, well, you know, we can't take him literally because nobody would actually do that, right? Nobody would actually build a wall. Nobody would actually ban Muslims. But here he is trying to do those things. It's shocking, although it shouldn't be, right? At this point, we shouldn't be surprised, and yet somehow we still are.
Yeah, well, you know what? I thought I had something to say to that, but I don't, because that sums it up perfectly. We shouldn't be surprised, but somehow we still are. You know, I used to play a game where called Death Strike, where It was a very college boy game. How it worked was you were at any moment, if you felt like it, you could walk up to someone else who had agreed to play, and you could take your forefinger and your middle finger, and you put them together in like a martial arts sort of like thing, and you would just pound the other person in one of their pectoral muscles as hard as you can. Uh-huh. And the agreement in this really stupid game that I wish I didn't love so much, but I did and probably would still play if I could, like if people would not look at me like, what's your problem? But is that the agreement with that was that if you did that to what to the other person, if I walked up to you and did that, the agreement was that then I had to stand there and let you do it back to me. So it wasn't just like I got you and then I ran away. I knew when I decided to nail you as hard as I can by surprise that you were going to get a free one right then and there on the spot. And you would think that it would stop being surprising, like how bad it would hurt when some, but it didn't. I was always surprised. And I feel like that is what a Trump presidency feels like to me. Like, I know He's going to do these things, yet. And so in one sense, I'm not surprised, but in another sense, I feel like every time he does it, someone took their two strongest fingers and dug them so deep into my pecs that they might have bruised a rib.
Yeah.
So, woof.
Woof.
Was there any, you went to the Air and Space Museum while you were down there, didn't you?
Yeah. So let's take this in a slightly different direction, right?
let's try to climb out of hopelessness for a second and talk about
it. Yeah, so whenever I go to D.C., I try to swing by the Air and Space Museum. It's like you know, between for me, you know, as a lifelong aviator, aviation enthusiast, and of course, career Air Force officer and pilot, the Air and Space Museum, both the one that's downtown on the National Mall, the Smithsonian, and the Udvar-Hazy Annex out by Dulles Airport, those two locations plus the United States Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, are kind of like Mecca to me, right? All of the things that have motivated me throughout my life are on display in those locations. And so whenever I'm in D.C., I try to swing by, see all the latest stuff. And they've recently done a number of renovations in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum on the Mall. So if you haven't been there in a number of years and you're in town, you should absolutely go check it out. There's always new things there. And on the heels of the Women's March, I found going to that museum and seeing a lot of the displays and artifacts and evidence of human achievement to be very encouraging. There's an area that they have a kind of a new display area that they call the Pioneers of Flight. And they talk about people, maybe some lesser known heroes of the development of aviation in America. One of those individuals is a African American by the name of William Powell. He was an infantry officer in World War I and had met aviators there. And when he came back from the war, was intent to become a pilot and also to bring African Americans into the field of aviation. And he did this work in the depths of the Great Depression. In Los Angeles, he started an organization called the Bessie Coleman Flight School that specialized in providing flight training to African Americans. And he ended up personally training hundreds of them as well as writing a book called Black Wings that encouraged African Americans to take up aviation and to get them into the business of aviation. He really wanted to create jobs with these aviation efforts in the 30s, right? This is pioneering work. When William Powell received his pilot license in 1929, there were about 1,800 registered pilots in the United States. 12 of them were African Americans.
Oh, wow.
You know, he was right there at the beginning, at a time when people thought that African Americans were incapable of flying airplanes, right? That they just didn't have the cognitive skill or the hand-eye coordination or whatever nonsense to do that. And he, you know, all his work flew directly in the face of that. And he sort of planted this idea, not only to get hundreds of African Americans involved in aviation, in the depths of the Great Depression, but he cemented this concept of African Americans flying airplanes into the American consciousness. And so when World War II broke out and we needed millions of people, including many, many thousands of pilots to fight the war, this concept was there. And so when another pioneer by the name of Benjamin O. Davis Jr., who was the first African-American to graduate from the U.S. Military Academy, said, hey, I'm going to start an African-American aviation division, and we're going to show that African-Americans can fight the war and fly fighters and do as good a job as anybody, that idea was there. Of course, Benjamin O. Davis founded the Tuskegee Airmen, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of. There was an organization called the 399th Fighter Wing, whose job it was to escort bombers over Germany and Italy when they were doing bombing runs. And they have the singular distinction in aviation history of having never lost one of their bombers that they escorted to enemy fighters, which no unit in history can make that kind of boast, including all the white fighter wings that were in service at the time, right? And they had to undergo tremendous prejudice and adversity to achieve that. So, it kind of reminded me that, because, in the Great Depression, it would have been very easy to say, holy Toledo, the economy has collapsed, double-digit unemployment, we're never going to climb out of this hole. You know, at the time, there was talk of a socialist revolution. But here was a guy who was saying, no, we're gonna continue to forge ahead and make actual progress in an actual field. And, we're all better off for it today.
So did they say Holy Toledo in the Depression?
They might have. I think that was an expression that they used at the time. Yeah.
Okay. So sorry, we couldn't pass that up.
Yeah.
Well, and also I had no idea about that. What the most interesting part of that, at least to me, besides just the fact that it's the Great Depression, is the fact that, like you were saying, the restrictions on things that African Americans could do back then were staggering,
yeah.
Like significant.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good reminder sometimes. It's easy. I know I have a lot of friends who are middle class white people who wake up and they're like, Trump is president. There's nothing I can do.
Right.
And like people have had it. I mean, we're at a pretty rough time right now in American history, but people have had it worse before, and we have
sure.
to remember that. Especially,
yeah.
I mean, and those are my middle class white friends. Like, that's not even like the people I know. It's not any of my African American friends or anybody who might be Muslim or anything like that that has a lot more to lose from a Trump presidency. But this story reminds me that on the days where I get up and I'm just like, how do I pick myself up? I kind of have to just remember that in the broader context of things, there have been tougher battles fought and won. And so I need to kind of like buck up a little bit.
That's it, right? It's not just that people have had it worse. It's not just that, you need to clean your plate and eat your vegetables because people in Africa are starving. It's that.
But that worked on me, just so you know. Like when I was in school, that worked on me a lot.
That might work.
I still do it.
Right?
I still clean my plate for that very reason, just FYI.
A little bit of a guilt trip, right? But of course, the rest of that sentence is, and they're also raising their own vegetables and eating them, right? That they are doing things to alleviate their hunger. And they didn't just have it bad in the Great Depression. They didn't accept it, right? And they decided to do the work that you need to do to alleviate those conditions and build the kind of world that you want to live in. And so we have to do that. We have to, and certainly in the 20s, 30s, 40s, through the civil rights efforts of the 60s and 70s, sure, there were lots of people who were politically active and who are out there earning their, you know, not earning their rights, getting their rights recognized, getting legislation passed, et cetera, marching. But there are also people like William Powell who were forging ahead in their chosen fields to do the hard work to build the kind of world that they want to live in.
Yeah, and I think that that's something, personally, that's something I have to remind myself a lot, is that I have to build the world that I want to live in. Because I think before this election, I was politically active, but I wasn't, well, I mean, I was politically aware. I think that's a better way of saying it. I was politically aware. I was educated on most of the things going on. I would talk to friends and relatives about issues of the day. I even got into my fair amount of like Thanksgiving arguments and Facebook fights. But the election made me realize that I need to be doing something outside of the bubble that I'm in. I have to do something outside of just telling my Uncle Don that that's racist. Please don't say it during Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I think it had, I've realized that I've had to, and looking back, it's helpful because again, you have stories like this where people had it worse. The battles were larger and they got up and they did the work and they made the world they wanted to live in.
Yeah.
I read a quote recently, which I don't have in front of me, so I'm just going to say the first sentence, but it said that the only fights worth fighting are the ones you're going to lose. And there's a longer thing that comes after that, which is very insightful. And if I, maybe I'll see if we can put that in the show notes because I don't remember who said it either, but I heard it, I looked it up, and it really came down to the fact that like, when we think about major accomplishments that have happened over the years, civil rights, the women's right to vote, gay marriage, there were years, decades, in some cases centuries, where people were fighting for that and losing, but making ground. And the only reason that the people who came along and were able to break those doors open were able to do it is because of all the people who were laying the groundwork. And here's the thing, the people who eventually broke the doors open, they didn't know if they were going to break the doors open. They were doing the work, and sooner or later, the result that you want will manifest. But it might not be while I'm alive for some of these things, but I still have to go out and do the work, and I still have to go out there and do my part so that if that is the case, that there's a good groundwork laid for whoever comes after me.
Sure.
And that makes me think of all the stuff I've been doing this week.
Let's hear it.
Which is calling my senator on a regular basis, every day, actually. Now, there's a lot of different ways that people have talked about being active. There's a lot of different things that people have talked about in terms of what's most effective and what is effective, what isn't effective. A big thing that's going around right now is the Indivisible Handbook, which you can find at indivisible.org. which is a handbook put together by a bunch of former congressional staffers. I was going to try to guess where it came out of, but it doesn't matter because I'm going to get it wrong. And indivisible.org will have all the information you need. But it's basically this short handbook about these congressional staffers who talk about their experience being at Congress when the Tea Party kind of rose to become a force in American politics. And they talk about all the strategies and tactics that the Tea Party employed, and they talk a lot about how the Tea Party were largely successful in these things. I mean, that's part of the reason, there's a big reason that we have President Donald Trump. It's part of the reason that I feel like I'm getting death punched on a daily basis. So I read through it, and there's a lot of stuff in there that's really helpful, one of which is going to town halls and asking questions.
Yeah.
But I'm going to get into the fact that I call my senator or congressman daily. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how I do it and how people out there, if you're interested in getting involved, how you can do it and how it's intimidating. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, at first, I'm not intimidated by it anymore, but I was when I started. And I used to be a telemarketer a long time ago, which was a job I hated. But so I'm a little more suited to it than most.
Uh-huh.
I was used to calling people. I called people in the 90s and I would say things like, hello, could I speak with Mr. Martin, please? Hi, Mr. Martin. I'm calling from Sprint and I want to talk to you about our plan, The Most, which if anybody was alive in the 90s remembers that The Most was like, it was like MCI's Friends and Family, only not as good. And I had to sell that. I was like the number three company, long distance company, and no one wanted to buy it because no one likes telemarketers. But my point is that sort of trained me, that and 12 years of Catholic school totally trained me to talk to a representative who has no interest in what I have to say.
Sure.
that's the part that gets people a little bit hung up, is they're like, because in some cases you're either going to be calling some of your blue state people to be like, keep doing what you're doing, please.
Right.
Or maybe occasionally you'll fight them on an issue where you're like, you need to be further left on this. Or if you're like me, you have at least one or two Republican representatives in my state. In Pennsylvania, we have Senator Pat Toomey. And I'd love to go to a town hall, because in the Indivisible Guide, they talk about how town halls and what to do at town halls and how that's the most effective way to get through to your senator.
Right.
I'd love to do that. But Mr. Toomey hasn't met with the Pennsylvania, or with anybody from Philadelphia anyway. He hasn't had a town hall in or around Philadelphia since 2013.
Sure. He hasn't had to.
Exactly. He hasn't had to. And so we've been demanding, a lot of people have been demanding that he come in to give a town hall, and his people keep saying, you know, maybe we'll see, who knows. He's done town halls. They say that a lot. He's done a number of town halls. I'm like, not around here. But so we call on issues. I've been calling mainly about the Affordable Care Act, because I'm going to lose my health insurance if they don't come up with a solution. If they decide to repeal without replace, then I will have to find new health insurance. Yeah. And I'm a little concerned that pre-existing conditions are going to come back. Because I know how the world works.
Sure.
But the issue is, if you're going to call your congressman about anything, here's how you do it. There's three. A lot of people get worried because they think they have to call, and they think they have to have all the answers, and they think that they have to be able to debate the staffers. And that's actually not true.
That's a very liberal perspective, right? That I have to know what I'm talking about. But of course. It's not the case. And that certainly wasn't the case of the Tea Party, right? They didn't show up at all these things saying, I better not speak up unless I really know what I'm talking about. They were more than happy to tell their senators that they were highly displeased with their conduct, having no idea what they were talking about.
No idea. I couldn't say it better myself. And you have to remind yourself of that. So it helps if you know one or two things, right? But here's the thing, you don't actually have to know. And that's what's really important. Because, that's a very liberal idea. The idea that you have to, I can't just raise my hand and say I don't like it. And then they go, what would you do? I can't just stare at them. You can, actually. You can. It's their job to make the fixes that you want them to make. And if they go, how do you, in a really crude setting, if they say, how do you suppose we do it? You could actually say, that's your job. But all I want to tell you is that I don't like what you're doing.
Sure.
So there's three categories that I've broken down why you would call your senator. And when you call, you want to know ahead of time what sort of category you're in. I'll name them really quick. There's the convince or encourage good behavior sort of category, which is what we were just talking about. Calling up and being like, hey, there's this issue. It means a lot to me. Here are some points. I really want you to help me convince the senator he or she needs to do this or that. So that would be like if I was calling up and I'm like, Pat Toomey, I hear you're undecided on the Affordable Care Act. Well, which he is not, but we'll pretend he is for a minute. And I would say, Pat Toomey, here are some things that you need to know about the Affordable Care Act. For one, premiums were rising at a higher rate before the ACA took place. So even though premiums have risen, and that's a real struggle for a lot of families, they were actually going up higher before. And yes, the status quo has been a little bit upset by the ACA. There's a lot of people who are paying higher premiums than before, like significantly. But we can fix that inside of the ACA. And there's a couple of ways to do it, and one of which is just to expand Medicare even further than we have it. And another one is to like allow interstate commerce inside of the healthcare exchanges, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of ways to do it. That's me calling up and saying, hey, here's some talking points that I'm sure you've heard. I want you to know that I, a constituent, have these ideas. I really think you should put these into practice, I guess is the best way to say it.
Yeah.
And the staffer will write them down. But here's the deal. The staffer doesn't really, the person you're talking to is an intern or some low-level staffer. They're not really, you don't have to change their mind. Even in a convince and encourage, you're really calling to be like, maybe you want to get the staffer in a good mood, maybe to say, hey, think about this, think about that. And then they'll pass it up. But like that's not
right.
The chances of you getting Phil to agree with you and then go tell Senator Toomey are kind of slim. But if you're going to call and convince, you want to have your facts, and you want to write them out ahead of time. Just write them out and give them, and then there you go.
Sure.
Now there's the second one. So that's the liberal. That's the liberal one. I think that's the one that everyone thinks they've got to do. To be honest, that's the one you use the least often, because most of the guys usually have their minds made up. So you're either calling to push them further to the left, like I've got a left-leaning senator, and next week I got to call him, and I'm going to lean into him a little bit and be like, you're up for re-election in 2 years, and here's some things that I need you to do now that Trump is president if you want my vote, or I'll vote for somebody who is more liberal than you.
Yeah.
The issue here is that if you want to convince and encourage, you want to have your facts. You want to, and I would encourage writing them out in bullet points, and don't worry, you're going to get a little bit jittery calling. It's just part of the process. Mm-hmm. But guess what? You really don't have to do that much. The one that I engage in the most often is what I would call the punish obstruct method. This is where Senator Toomey said something like last week when he said that people with pre-existing conditions are a lot like burned out buildings, and they want the Department of Housing to come and pay for them after they've burned down. Something like that. Something relatively insensitive.
And reductive and just not really reflective of what's actually going on.
Exactly. Not reflective of what's going on. Now, you can call up with a sort of like punish convince method where you're like, I'm really mad and here's what you should be doing. But
yeah.
I go the punish obstruct, and here's the reason. Right now, the Republicans are pushing an agenda, and I know that I'm probably not going to change Pat Toomey's mind. Now, I hope I do, but I don't think I'm going to. So what I'm really going to do is I'm going to stand in the way and make his doing of what he wants as absolutely difficult and slow as possible, which is a lot of what the Tea Party did in 2010.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to call up, and I have a group that I talk to on Facebook every day. It's called the Defensive Line, and anybody who wants to join it can join it. You can find it. It's a closed group. You have to request to be a member, but all you have to do is have a heartbeat and willing to call people, and you can be a member. And there's about 200 people in the group, and every day I put out a, this is who we're calling, and this is why we're calling, and this is what we're going to say roughly. And to punish slash obstruct, we call up, and the key is you have to do it in numbers, so that's why we have a group. You call up, and I use open-ended questions. I call up, and I say, excuse me, could you tell me why Senator Toomey compares people with pre-existing conditions to burned-out buildings? And then I stop talking.
Right.
And then, because I've been that person who has to answer the phone,
yeah.
And then that person feels compelled to answer the question. You don't call up and say, did Senator Toomey call people with pre-existing conditions burned out buildings? Because then they'll say, yes, no,
yeah.
Or they'll say, yes, yeah. But he was misunderstood. You say, why did he say this thing? And then you stop talking. And then you let them spin for as long as they want, because some of them will talk for a while.
Uh-huh.
And then you let them go. You don't get in their way.
Sure.
And then you drop a second question on them, which we usually figure out ahead of time. I mean, if you're really good at this, and I've been doing it for a little bit, so I'm getting better, you can probably pick up on things they're saying and pick their argument apart. But you don't need to be able to do that. You just say your first question, you let them spin, and then you drop a second that sort of related question. And so in this case, when they would say, well, it's out of context, it's this and that, it's this and that. The second question is usually something like, doesn't he understand, though, that people with pre-existing conditions are people who need help, and they need help from people like him? And again, you stop talking and you let them spin and spin and spin and spin. And then when they're done, you say, well, and then you have a statement already written down that you're going to say. And that statement is something along the lines of like, well, I'm really upset with Senator Toomey for saying that. And if he wants to keep my vote, and in this case, it's a long shot because Senator Toomey is not up for re-election for another 6 years. But
right.
You say, if he wants to keep my vote, if he wants to keep me happy, if he wants to engage his constituents, he needs to be a little more sensitive when he talks about this. And I'm going to let you know that I'm really upset, and I'm going to keep calling back until I get some real motion out of him on this issue. Now, I could have just called up and said that right away. But the reason that I call with those two questions is to make the staffer's days a little more difficult. And it means that they can't be doing work. They have to deal with me. And I'm not being terribly rude, although some days I am. Some days I get really nasty. Not nasty like rude, but nasty like argumentative with them. And I keep them on the phone for upwards of like 10 or 12 minutes. But you ask those open-ended questions, you let them answer, and then you spit a different question. And then at the end, you give them, and they're going to say, would you like me to pass that on to the senator? You say, yes, I do. My name's Terry Brennan, and my zip code is 19145. And make sure you give the zip code, because they tally all this and they need the zip code. And sometimes if they don't want to count your thing, they'll try to just get your name. It's a technical thing that I learned doing this. Make sure they get your name and zip code. But I could have just called up and said that right away. I could have just called and said, I'm mad about this. I'm going to call back. And they would say, thank you. And that would take like 30 seconds. But I want to hold their day up. And every time the senator does something that is controversial or against my interests, I want his staff to cringe at the amount of phone calls they're going to get, because this actually will cause them, when he's actually like talking to people and being like, I don't know, Phil, what do you think? And I know that Phil, the staffer, doesn't give Pat Toomey a lot of this stuff, but whoever runs the office definitely probably has.
Somebody is talking to that senator or member of Congress saying, holy Toledo, I'm going to be on the phone all day long.
Holy Toledo.
Thanks, Toomey.
No, and that's exactly right. And I want him to think about that. And it's a long game. It's not a short game. It's like a it's like a year or two game. So, I mean, I've been doing this for like 3 weeks, so we've only started. But you want to this is what the Tea Party has done, and this is what some Republicans have done, where they just push an agenda like unapologetically. And I do think that there's a lot to be said about the liberal mindset of getting all the information and things. That's the reason I'm a liberal. But there's also something to be said about pushing really hard and being sort of mean about it to affect the way they think. Because the right has really pushed this nation really far to the right with tactics like this.
They have.
And we're not going to suddenly get consensus. We need to push back a little bit. So the punish obstruct one is, I would call that a medium level call. I think anyone can do it. All you have to have is two questions and a sentence at the end, and you have to have a bunch of other people that'll do it with you. Anytime you do this, it only matters if lots of people call. That's the only time it really makes a difference. Yeah. So get some friends, even if it's just like 5 to 10 friends. I heard one day, I don't know if this holds true now, but early on in the whole Senate, because the Senate started like 2 weeks before, 2 or 3 weeks before Trump took office, when the Senate started their session off, someone said, wow, we sure got a lot of calls about that today. And someone said, how many was that? And they said 17. And someone was like, wow, 17's a lot of calls.
17. Holy Toledo.
Holy Toledo is right, Batman. So that's so punish obstruct, anyone can do. It's like a mid-level call, but if you have two questions, a sentence, you can do it. Your call might only last 3 minutes, but that's longer than the 30 seconds to a minute that it takes this next one. The third one is just what I call the be heard call. This is one anyone can do, and it has effect. It doesn't. The punish obstruct is the most effective, in my opinion, but the be heard is you literally just call up and you're like, hi, I am offended that Senator Toomey said that people with pre-existing conditions are burned out buildings.
Yeah.
I want more sensitivity from him, and I want him to come up with a real solution. Please pass that on. And here's the thing. Your rep or whoever's on the phone is not going to argue with you. I think a lot of people are worried that Phil is going to be like, well, he didn't mean that. Now, if he does, in cases like so-and-so said this, I'm upset, sometimes they will try to clarify. And then you say, all you have to say is, I appreciate that. I just want you to pass it along to the senator. And they'll do it. They don't care. They want to get you off the phone. And if you are nervous about making these calls, the be heard one is the easiest one to do. Make a short list. I sometimes write the sentences out, and I'm loose with it so I don't sound like I'm reading. But I just say, like, hi, I'm calling. I'm kind of upset about this and this. And I've said, I want the senator to press for the ACA to stay available. Uh-huh. I don't want him to repeal it.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely opposed to that. But all they say is, okay, well, thank you very much. Can I have your name and zip code? And they pass it on. So it's actually painless. People get a little jittery. I know on the obstruction ones, which we've been doing a lot of, people talk about getting off the phone and they're still shaking a little bit, and it takes them like 5 minutes to like listen to some music and calm down. And I get it, because like we're not really trained for what's the word I'm looking for? Confrontation.
We're not trained for confrontation, and we're really not brought up with the expectation that it is up to us to actually influence our politicians, right? We're kind of brought up with the idea that we should vote and that we should care a little bit about politics and maybe know some things, but we're really not brought up with the idea that we should get personally involved and that we can talk to our members of Congress and they have to listen to us.
Exactly. And when I did telemarketing, I got a job as a telemarketer when I was like 16, and I hated every minute of it, but I did it for like 3 years. The first time I had to make a phone call, we had to do a test call. The first time we made a test call, I called some guy in California to try to sell him Sprint at 10 in the morning on a Saturday. I called him and he answered the phone and I totally freaked out and hung up, because talking to a stranger and trying to convince them of anything was a really intimidating idea. So what I like to tell people by making these calls, especially the Be Heard calls, is you don't have to convince. You just have to call and report. You have to call and say, I would like this to happen. And if that starts to get easier, or if you if you just feel some people have like a very like nagging like responsibility feeling where they're like, I feel like I must do more, even though I'm scared of it, then I would argue for the punish obstructing calls.
Yeah.
The key is that you have to do it with a group. Really, all of this is just about one person, unfortunately, in this context, doesn't really make a difference, but five do. You know, and in the case that I'm dealing with, I know that there's at least, I would guess, based on how many people are on this group and how many people, like, we send Facebook messages back and forth all day being like, I talked to Phil's a real guy, by the way. Phil's the one no one wants to talk to at Pat Toomey's office. Hmm. But Phil's argumentative, and he's actually kind of good. And so you're like, oh, I got Phil.
Yeah.
But Phil, right? You're like, I got filled. But
filled.
But we go back and forth, and I would guess there's anywhere between 15 and 25 people calling a day. There might be more. I hope there's more. There's 200 people in the group. But as we all know, if 200 people are in the group, I'd say that probably, give or take, like 30% of those people are making calls. So I hope it's a solid 30, but who knows? But my point is it's better than just me calling, because they're like, hey, Terry called again.
Yeah,
he's mad about Obamacare, and they all have a good laugh and don't do anything about it. But if 20 people call, they take notice. And if 20 people call and keep them on the phone for 3 to 4 minutes apiece, now you're eating up anywhere between an hour and a half of their day. And lately, when we've been calling, we get busy signals all day long. It's really hard to get through anymore. And I think that's because there's a couple of groups in town calling them. But so the three ones, just to wrap this, you know, there's the convince, encourage good behavior. That usually is, that's rare. But if someone's, I called about Betsy DeVos today and I said, I heard he's undecided. And they said, yes, Toomey is undecided. I said, all right, well, here's some things that I think he should take into consideration. And, you know, that's really all I got. And I was very nice. And they go, thanks. And I go, thank you. And I actually called a separate time about the ACA. And I was a little turdier. And, I wasn't super on it today. I probably only ate up about maybe 5 or 6 minutes of their day. On a good day, I've eaten up like 12. Me and Phil got into it one day. Huh. I called a separate time for that other thing.
12 minutes, huh?
12 minutes. And I yelled, that's been debunked a whole bunch. That's been debunked. And Colleen came downstairs and was like, are you okay? I'm like, I'm fine. I'm talking to Phil. But and then there's the Be Heard one. And if you're unsure, do the Be Heard. You can just call up. Hi, my name's Terry. I think Pat Toomey shouldn't compare people to burned out buildings. 19145. Thank you very much. Goodbye. Takes 30 seconds. Right. And if you're still kind of freaked out afterwards, that's totally normal. It gets easier. The best thing I can say is it gets easier, but it's like you said, we've never been expected to convince our elected officials of things before.
Right.
And so the paradigm has shifted a little bit.
Yeah.
And so it can be a little intimidating. Yeah. It can be a little bit freaky.
I imagine that's really going to get their attention. If a heavy day on the phones in the past has been 17 calls, if they are now getting dozens to hundreds of calls a day, and people are talking about the same things, you know, over and over again, that they're sort of resonating these same concerns, I got to think that's going to get their attention.
That's the other thing, which is really important, I think, for people to remember, which I mean, it wears on me. Like, I lead this group. Like, I'm the person who writes the scripts. I'm the person who, like, asks people to do it. So I who do all this preparation for it, I get bored. Not bored, but I feel like I'm being repetitive some days.
Yeah.
But you have to, because there's a craving for novelty. There's a craving to call about something new. And that it's important. You got to switch gears every now and again. But if they're hearing this, if you think you hate saying the same thing over and over again, put yourself in their shoes and imagine that they're getting anywhere from 20 to 50 calls about the same issue. Yeah. That's the only way you sort of like get some traction and create change.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if I may, this is really exciting for me, Matt, and I hope I stay with me on this one because I'm really pumped about my military history here.
Okay.
I've compared this with some friends. I've compared this push that I'm making right now, mainly against Senator Toomey, because the other thing is you can call the White House and stuff. You want to keep this as local as possible because that's where you can affect the most change.
Yes.
It is important to be involved on national issues. And since I'm calling a senator, I am weighing in on national issues, but I'm trying to get my Pennsylvania senator. I don't call anybody from Arkansas or Alabama because they don't care about what I have to say. I'm not their voter.
Right.
I call my person and I'm like, my person, I want you to do this thing. And the issue here is that I've compared it to the Battle of Thermopylae more than once, where I've said, in this first like 100 to 120 days, Trump and the Republicans are going to push as much as they can. They're part of it is to test to see how much they can get through. And that's every presidency does that in their first 100 days.
Sure.
And so I said, we might lose the ACA fight. We might lose, we've called about the Muslim ban. We might lose that one, even though Toomey says that he's against it. He won't. He's like, I posted something months ago about that. I'm like, post it again, bro.
Yeah.
You need to speak up against your president. This is your party's leader. You need to be the one talking to him. But the point is while it feels repetitive, you got to treat it like the Battle of Thermopylae. The Spartans were able to blunt the offensive of the Persians significantly. Mm-hmm. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, military historians talk about how that if that battle hadn't taken place, the Persians may well have walked all over Greece eventually.
Oh, sure.
And changed the tide of the battle. So none of those guys lived. So, like, we might lose these battles. We might not actually get – I might not actually get Pat Toomey to – change his mind on the ACA. But, man, I can really make the next fight so – painful for him because he's like, are they going to call again? And BT dubs, Pat, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
I've compared it to the Battle of Thermopylae in the sense that, like, we have to sort of blunt this offensive. I can't stop them from doing it, but I can absolutely get in the way and I can make it as hard as possible for them to carry through with their constituency.
Right. That's right. I'm right there. Yeah.
I'm very excited to bring that up on the podcast. I've been saying it for a week and I'm like, I do a podcast about military. I should bring this up.
And of course, this was a very key series of engagements. It led to the decline of Athens and the rise of Sparta. Yeah, there were 300 Spartans who kind of fended off the Persians. They were backed up by another 5,000 to 8,000 other Greeks. They get a little bit shorter shrift.
Yeah, I know. They when you do the numbers, you're like, but if I'm correct, it was still a pretty. They were pretty overwhelmed anyway. Is that right, correct?
They were over. Yeah, they were up against 10,000 to 15,000 Persians. But they found good ground, as we say. They found a place where they could leverage their defensive position and really clobber, really stick it to the, you know, make them fight for every inch of terrain. That changed the world history.
So that's kind of the way that I talk about it, because I think a lot of people get frustrated and they say, well, he's already doing the stuff. I can't stop him. I'm like, well, you know what? In the short term, you might not be able to, but
yeah.
But we can absolutely slow it down and make it miserable. And again, like, the Tea Party definitely blunted Obama's supermajority.
Yes.
So I've read that we as Democrats are actually in a better place right now strategically than the Tea Party was in 2008. And I think we need to remember that because it's easy to get a little bit doom and gloom. And there's a lot of doom and a lot of gloom to go around.
Well, the thing is, we're already starting with a majority of Americans.
Exactly.
Right? The Tea Party didn't have that. And I think it's already paying dividends. I don't think it's a coincidence. I mean, you know, it's totally unscientific and who knows what's really in the minds of different people. But I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, in the week after, you know, what was probably the largest protest or series of protest events in history, 3 million people around the world. The week after that, you have, you know, individuals in the National Park Service, you know, making it a point to tweet actual facts about climate change. You have all of the senior managers of the State Department resigning. I think it's having an effect, right? So we got to keep working at it.
I would agree. And right now, I think that we're at a crest. Like right now, a lot of people are like, there's a lot of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important to know two things. We want to keep the enthusiasm up. And that's going to get harder.
Yeah.
The other thing is for all those people out there that are doing it, right? Some of the people you know will stop doing it. Don't let that get you down.
Sure.
I've done a lot of stuff like this in the past. And what I've found is there's crests and I guess peaks and valleys is maybe a better way to put it.
Yeah.
And when we're in the valleys, when there's not as much participation, I say to myself, that's okay. I'm going to keep doing the work.
Yeah.
And we will get to another peak. And some of those people will flake out eventually. And that's okay. Like, I think sometimes people get demoralized when not everyone has as much drive as they do. Some of us just have more drive than others and it's okay. Like, I don't mind doing a little bit of the heavy lifting for other people. Like, when people go away and come back, I'm not a jerk when they come back. I'm like, where were you? I just say, welcome back.
Right.
And use their energy while I have it.
Yeah. It's hard, right? You know, most people have jobs or school or kids And that takes up all your time and energy. And at the end of the day, you just want to have dinner and watch a show or whatever. And you don't necessarily feel like going to a meeting or picking up the phone and calling your representatives. You gotta stay focused.
Yeah, I call every day. I call every day, and I kind of dread that call almost every day. And I dread it a little less every day, but, like, so my point is just that, like, yeah, I feel you. And, yeah, you're right. Like, but so when people in your life stop being active, don't totally hate them. And maybe convince them to come back in for a thing or two. That's the other thing is I just have to remember, like, I have ADHD, which gives me a lot more drive and a lot more energy than most people around me. That's the H part, the hyperactivity. Like, I'm just like, and some people are just extra motivated. People like that have to remember that not everybody has as much drive, or they're not as motivated. Like, my problem is people have to keep me on task. They're like, dude, he's got a lot of energy, but it's everything. But I think that it's important to remember to love your friends who kind of melt away and bring them back in the fold when you can. So,
absolutely.
Really quick, we've been talking, we probably have to wrap it up. We've been talking a little bit about what we can do on a weekly basis. And one of the things that I talked about before was making these phone calls. I've been doing a lot of that. And so this week, we're going to talk about, like, actionable steps we can do. The actionable step that I'm going to take this week is going to sound a little bit unorthodox, but I'm going to try really hard. While making my calls, I'm going to keep up the momentum that I've got going, but I'm going to try to take a little bit of a social media break. I do a lot of this on social media, so I will still be on social media.
Okay.
However, I'm going to try to limit my intake because I have found that it is eating a little bit of my life. The nature of 24-hour news combined with the nature of social media combined with the nature of the Trump presidency is one of those things where when I'm making these calls, I check in with all my friends to see how their calls went. And then I, like, read a news story, and then I try to get a tip from a friend on, like, maybe what's a better way of making these calls. And I find that I'm online way more than I want to be, but I can't tear myself away. And in some ways it actually makes me a little bit less effective because I'm emotionally drained by like 1 p.m.
Yeah.
And I still, you know, most days I don't even go to work until 3. So, like, I get to work and they're like, you look beat. And I'm like, I've been politicking. So what I'm going to work on this week is a little bit of self-care where I'm going to keep doing my things, but much like a marathon runner, I'm going to try to pace myself and I'm not just going to eat social media all day long and try to affect Trump's brain by reading Facebook as hard as I can, or Twitter, or whatever the social media du jour is for me that particular day.
This is going to be a marathon. It's not going to be a sprint. You've got to be able to sustain yourself. You've got to get good sleep. You've got to exercise. Don't take your phone to bed.
Oh, God.
Read a book instead. Sustain a high level of energy versus a manic level of energy that you can't sustain for more than a short period of time.
Yeah, do things that you enjoy. Do things that you enjoy. Like, I have a couple of friends who feel guilty right now about doing anything that isn't fighting the man. And that's a recipe for burnout. Those are your friends. So some of your friends are flakes and some of your friends will burn out because they work too hard. So remember to, like you were saying, hydrate. Go to bed early.
Yep.
You know, get some exercise. Do things you enjoy also mixed in with this, because otherwise you'll be useless in a month and a half.
Yeah, I think so. So a couple things that I'm going to do. So first of all, I will not be able to take a social media break this week because there's going to be some discussions at the highest levels about whether we're going to change the course of the military campaign in Iraq and northern Syria. You heard, I'm sure, Donald Trump talking about safe zones in Syria.
Oh, no, this is totally news to me. This is actually news.
You know, he, of course, during the campaign, Donald Trump, said he's going to bomb the shit out of ISIS, and to roaring applause. Of course, we've been doing that for almost two years now. In fact, we've dropped over 60,000 bombs on ISIS. And ISIS is pretty much in retreat all across, especially North Iraq and a few parts of Syria. You know, the Iraqi army has captured back most of Mosul and a few other key cities. But some of my friends in the military have told me just in the past week that there has been an increase in bombing activity. And this week, General Mattis, who's now the Secretary of Defense, is going to be discussing a change in the strategy with his top generals. Donald Trump talked about safe zones, which is establishing areas in Syria where refugees could go and not be pursued by the Syrian army or by ISIS or by whoever. There's dozens of different actors in that part of the world that are doing terrible things. But of course, it's easy to say that you're going to establish a safe zone. But to make it safe, you have to send people in there to do that, right? You have to send some force on the ground. You really can't do this just through air power alone. And that's gonna bring some costs with it, right? Potentially thousands of troops will have to be deployed. And of course, there's going to be a huge financial burden to go along with this. We could probably, up until now, our approach has been to leverage allies, particularly the Kurds, but other coalition players in the region. But what Donald Trump is talking about is a much more unilateral U.S. approach to trying to directly prosecute ISIS. So I'm going to be paying attention to that over the next week, because if Donald Trump starts talking about sending thousands upon thousands of Americans into Iraq and northern Syria, some of them will be killed. And we really need to think about if that's something that we want to do. That's one thing I'm going to do. I'm going to be paying attention to those discussions.
Okay, so my social media break will be mostly.
You may want to check in from time to time and see how things are going.
Yeah, I mean, I planned on checking in, but now I think I'll use that as I try to be focused. I try to go in and look for very specific things. So I'll look at that because I didn't know that, and that worries me a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. Another thing is that the Dallas County Democrats are going to be hosting a series of events to help people organize, start groups, launch campaigns, and maybe even run for office themselves. I've been kicking around the idea of maybe running for town council or county commission or some local part-time office. I'm not ready to quit my day job just yet, but something that, I could sort of get directly involved at the local level. So I'm going to be going to some of these workshops to see about, how you do that. How do you actually run for a local office?
That's interesting. That's really good. I thought about that. There's a couple of meetings coming up that are not this week that I may go to that are similar. A couple of people have approached me and said, "You, Terry, should run for office." And I was like,
"Yeah."
And so I'm thinking about it. It makes me nervous though, because it makes me nervous for a lot of reasons. The big one is there's a lot of pictures of me out there, like a lot of pictures of me where I'm not wearing very many clothes. So, sure. I'd have to scrub the internet. I've told you can do it. There's companies that do it, but I'd have to go out and be like, "Yeah, the one with me just holding a hat. Yeah, we got to get rid of that."
I think you should just own it.
Well, actually, it's funny you say that. I actually thought about that. I'm like, you know what? I think if I was gonna run for I think the one that's coming up is there's an election one, and it's the one where I can't remember the name of it. Basically, you sit and you watch people vote. You sit there and you're like, "What's up? Hey, welcome. Which one are you?" Great. And then you mark them off. I don't think anyone would be like, "This man once had a Christmas ornament in front of his stuff." But also, I was like, you know what? I think if I'm going to run for something, I think I just have to be like, "Hey, man, I'm an actor. I do things. If you don't like it, don't vote for me."
In the age of Trump, that stuff just doesn't matter.
Well, no, it's true. Nobody cares. I mean, it's true. In the age of Trump, that actually doesn't, and I feel like he's kicked a few doors open I'd rather they were shut, but since they're open, I might as well use them to walk through.
You might as well walk on through.
Yeah, I've done a lot less. I've done a lot less. I haven't. Yeah. So anyway, I'll remember that. I'll just be like, maybe that'll be my campaign picture. It'll just be me and like a Christmas ornament and be like, "Hey, I'll check you in to vote." So
that should be your campaign, button picture or something.
Yeah. It's like me like half naked on a button holding a Christmas ornament saying, "I'll watch you vote."
Yeah, you got my vote.
Like, "Oh, I'm going to vote for that creepy guy who's going to watch me vote." Yeah. Well, all right, cool. So you're gonna look at that. I will take a partial social media break. You're gonna watch for the serious stuff and also look into running for office. That's kind of cool. So, yeah. All right. Well, you know, I know that you have places you need to be. I don't remember where. Oh, wait, you have a special fast car this weekend, right?
That's right. For my birthday, my wife rented me a Tesla Model S for the weekend. So I'm going to go drive it.
I'm going to take the bus to have drinks with somebody to talk a little bit about activism. So while you're driving your Tesla around, I'm going to be like flashing my sweet SEPTA card that we have here in Philadelphia that I can unlimited nice. Bus rides, Matt. I can go on the bus as many times as I want. I could go on a bus and then get on a different one and go right back, and then get on a different one and go right back to the first spot.
Just make sure you wield that responsibly.
Yeah, it's like I'm like Spider-Man on the bus. So,
like, all right.
Well, Matt, it was good talking to you again this week. I will see you over there.
And I will see you over there as well, Terry.
Indeed. Oh, now remember, sorry, I wanted to like wrap. I'm like, ooh, clever. And then I forgot to say, please, if you're listening and you like this, subscribe to us on iTunes. You can find us on iTunes at the Over There Podcast. If you search for us there, find us on Twitter at Over There Pod. You can find all of our tweets there, or on Facebook at Over There Podcast. For some reason, it comes up right now as Unofficial Over There, and I'm not sure why on Facebook. I'm trying to get that fixed, but it's if you type in Over There Podcast, it will come up, and you can find...
It's pretty official.
Yeah, it's pretty... I would say so, too. But anyway, if you find us on iTunes, also, please rate us. Please give us a 5-star rating, because the only way we can be found is when subscribers like yourself rate us, and then when other people go looking for podcasts to find... makes us come up on their feet a little more. So again, my name is Terry Brennan.
And this is Matt Martin.
All right, Matt, and I'll see you over there.
Over there, Terry. Over and out.
Over and... Oh, I like it. Over and out. So prepare, say a prayer. Send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over. And we won't come back till it's over, over there.